Factory Backing has been producing custom motocross graphics since 2004. At Factory Backing, they prioritize quality by using the finest vinyl materials available. Their competitive prices might seem surprising, but rest assured, they offer top-notch products specifically designed for motocross and the demands of dirt bike riders. Check them out at factorybacking.com. But act fast, as they are celebrating their 20th anniversary with a 50% off sale. Everyone, welcome to the Midweek Podcast presented by Factory Backing. Factory Backing is a custom graphic company owned by our friend Jared Austin, and they are celebrating their 20th year of producing high-quality, great-looking graphics. And right now at factorybacking.com, they are having a 50% off sale to celebrate their anniversary. So anyway, if you're in the market for a facelift or upgrade and appearance on your bike or even just numbers, give Factory Backing a call. I'm joined today by Jason Fonts of Fast House, and he's actually one of my oldest, longest running friendships in the motocross industry. I met you many, many years ago. You were 18, you said.
Yeah, through Rob Healy.
Almost 30 years ago. You were working at N-Style.
Yep.
I believe I was working at Cycle News.
Correct. You were the king of the 500s.
But yeah, so it's been crazy because we're both, so I'm 7 years older than you.
Yeah, I'm going to be 48 in May.
So I was 25 or something when I met you.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of crazy that we're still both in the motocross industry.
Agreed. I mean, for me, I'm not that smart, so this worked out very good for me. Got lucky. I tried to leave for a little bit and sold cars for a couple of years, and it was, I mean, good money, but it wasn't the same, family vibe that I have now with, you guys are my extended family.
Yeah. It's funny because my motocross career was, it's kind of like plan B, because that guy, when you go to college, you're like, all of a sudden you're free, right? Because there's no roll call.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh man. So I was commuting from Altadena to Long Beach State, and I'm like, oh fuck, I think I'll go riding instead,
Right?
So I was riding dirt bikes all the time and not going to class. And so I got kicked out of university in my third semester of school, and had to go back to community college to get my GPA up to get back into Cal State Long Beach.
No way. I didn't know that part of the life story.
Meanwhile, right, I'm like, when I started college, my dad's like, hey, no more dirt bikes. Or you can still ride and race, but I'm not paying for it anymore.
Yep.
This is the last bike I'm going to buy you. The last bike he ever bought me was a 89 Suzuki RM. 250.
Really? My first bike was 89 RM 125.
But anyway, so I'm like, okay, well, I'll figure out how to do this. And so I figured out that I could write race report stories for Cycle News, and Stu Peters at CMC would give me gate fee and race entry for free.
Heck yeah. That was like, so that was like winning a lottery.
That was just means to an end to go race, right? Yep. Like, I didn't care about writing or taking photos, but I had this little Nikon one step camera.
Yeah.
So I used to write these Cycle News stories, and lo and behold, I get kicked out of school, and then Cycle News calls me and goes, hey, it was Nate Rauba. His daughter works for Kawasaki's PR agency.
Okay.
Megan Rauba. But Nate calls and goes, hey, you're our best contributor. You want to come work here? There's this job doesn't open up very often. So I was like, my parents didn't know I got kicked out of school.
Right.
I just said, I want to go to Long Pasadena City College to try something different. But then I'm all, hey, I got this chance to be a newspaper reporter. What do you think? Yeah. And my dad's all, Bob, if it doesn't work, you're going to go back to school. And I go, I promise. But then worked out.
Yeah. Heck yeah. So that's where you're at now.
I'm working at Cycle News. I meet Rob Healy. I come hang out there. I meet you, Ryan Persley, and Dominic Gayton, who's now one of my best friends and my ad guy.
Yeah.
But my first memory of you, really vivid memory, was I had to shoot photos for a catalog, right?
I knew where this was going.
And we go to Lemon Grove, this track in Piru.
Yep.
And I remember you guys had all the Cinesol gear.
Yeah.
And the graphics on the bikes were all done up and everything. Every time I take a picture of you, you're like,
Yeah,
twisting your leg out.
So I was trying to whip it, and I don't know how to whip it, so I turn my heel and push. And you're like, "What are you doing with your foot?"
Yeah. I'm like, "What are you doing?" So I think I used to call you Twitch.
You did. Then, right? I was going to say I've been the OG Twitch.
Yeah, but that's my first vivid memory then. But yeah,
you've never let me forget about that photo shoot.
But for as long as I remember, you were 46, also, right?
Yeah, because Larry Nassen was my neighbor, and that's how I got into this industry. He was the announcer of Supercross at the time, and worked at Axo. And he introduced me into me and my father into the motorcycle industry. I actually had a go-kart first that I drove one time at El Mirage and never drove it again. Really? It was a sprint cart. Never drove it again. Just sat in the garage. And so Larry brought us into that. And that was the number that was on his bike when we bought one of his 250s. And it just stayed with me.
So you inherited the
46. Yeah. I figured at the time I was small and I figured I'd probably gradually go into that waist size. So my bike number was a reminder of my pant size.
Yeah. I think I made that joke.
Yeah, I think you have. But that's how it started for me was, the 46.
That's crazy. So yeah. Larry Nassen is a legendary announcer. He announced Supercross.
And NASCAR and a bunch of stuff. And he was very good to me growing up. And he, gave me gear and helped me ride and taught me a lot about how stuff's not free. And, we appreciate things you get from people. And, he introduced me to this industry. He opened the door for me.
Yeah.
And then Rob Healy gave me my first job. So I'm very fortunate. I've been very lucky in my career. Unlike you went to school for it
and lucked into it.
led you to it. I had a neighbor that kind of led me into it. And I knew in high school, I got kicked out of high school too, actually. I knew that was going to lead. I was never going to be a college guy. I could talk.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'll just do sales. And then so when Rob Healy gave me that job, I packaged numbers and backgrounds in the back all day, every day. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, click, staple, thousands of them a day.
Yeah.
And then Rob's like, man, this guy's got a personality. He's like, I think you could be good at sales. And then he started taking me to the races and introducing me to people and clients. And so I met Dahmer actually in person. After knowing him over the phone when he was a phone rep for Tucker, a customer service guy, at a different job that I had. But that's how it all started for me. Rob introduced me to the people in the industry, and it just became relationships and relationships. And that's how I've advanced my career in this industry. And I've been very lucky. I mean, very lucky to do what I do, go where I've gone, have the friends that I have. I mean, Dahmer's like, I talk to Dahmer every single day. And Ryan Persley from, InStyle, now Throttle Syndicate and InStyle. And it's been a great journey, and there's a lot of cool stories along the way. But you've been a part of it all too, which has been cool. Yeah.
So you talk about your neighbor. Did you grow up in Valencia then, or Canyon Country?
No, Palmdale. So we went from we were living in Canoga Park. My dad worked for Rocketdyne, which was on the shuttle program at the time, and they used to build the maneuvering motors for the space shuttle when it was in space. And they had a facility out in Palmdale. So my dad, he bought a house out there because he was going to transfer to Palmdale. Well, then they started laying off everybody at the Palmdale location. So he commuted his entire life until he passed away to Canoga Park. We moved to Palmdale, and that's when we bought that house in 83 is when we moved in there. And I think I met Larry either late 83, early 84. I was between 8 and 9 years old when I met Larry, and just a little punk kid. And at the time, he wasn't even in the industry. He was just a rider. He had a Yamaha YZ250 and worked at UPS.
Yeah.
And was trying to work his way into the industry.
You know, it's crazy is that... you think of the motocross industry, and it's like, well, a lot of the racers have moved back east and stuff, but like, it's boom. Southern California, like the Corona, the 909.
Yeah, right?
But the secondary was the 661 up there in the Valencia.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Valencia Canyon Country, there was Axo, there was N-Style. Oh, Garnet. Mechanics were Garnet, Cinesolo. All
Eddie Cole's businesses, Cinesolo, N-Style, Factory Effects was still there.
Yeah.
It was the Mecca. High Torque was still there, and then everybody kind of faded away.
You know, it's funny is... when I bought my first home, it was 2000, around 2000.
Was that the Valencia
1999,
house?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that was your first
1999,
house.
1999, I was working at MX Racer, right? So I went from Cycle News to Dirt Rider, and then Dirt Rider lasted only a year. I couldn't stand it, and I was going to quit.
Yeah, that was a short stint, I do recall.
So then they let me start MX Racer, and I remember going in to see my boss, and I was like, dude, Give me the lowdown. Are we safe here? Like, is MX Racer healthy enough? Like, 'cause I'm going to buy a house, dude. And that's a big deal for me, and I'm going to buy a house. And he goes, you're good. So I bought my first house in Valencia.
Yeah.
But the reason I chose Valencia is because I loved Lemon Grove.
Yeah, we used to ride there a lot. That's where I'd always see you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So I moved there. Boom, Lemon Grove gone.
Yep.
Closed down.
Yep, too many people get hurt there.
So... all I had was Gorman and LACR.
LACR, yeah.
But it was cool because that whole little community of motocross people and brands up there.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, it was awesome. You know, I'd go to Encel and hang out. Yeah. I'd go to Axo.
And go to lunch at Chi-Chi's. And then what was the other, Hamburger Hamlet that Healy always wanted to go to? Hamburger Hamlet. Yeah. Just cool. And you'd see everybody. We'd see Kehoe. Yamaha Troy was there. Honda Troy was there. Mm-hmm. You know, you were out there. Dahmer lived out there at the time. And you, I remember going to your house for some, I don't know if there were parties, barbecues, whatever, but it was fun.
Yeah.
It was cool.
Yeah, it was a good little community up there. Yeah. And I loved it because Ryan Persley lived down the street
from me. Yeah, you guys were in the same neighborhood
and, almost. I would ride a 50 to his house all the time. And so, but it would be like he'd call me to put tires on for him, and I'd call him to put graphics on.
Yeah, that's right.
But I was around the graphic thing so much that I learned how to do it pretty well, actually. Yeah. But I never got good at those horrible seat covers Anstel made with the graphic material on the side.
Yeah, those are hard to line up.
Yeah,
their printed seat covers were brutal. That was about the only thing I could do well was put the seat covers on. I was banned from graphic installation. We did a few things for Indie Trade Show, and Rob and Ryan are like, Fonzie, you do not touch the graphics. Yeah. You suck. I don't have the patience or the, yeah. And then I'm always removing them, and then the ink comes off and trying to straighten it. I just sent it to Ryan.
So it's pretty crazy to think back of, did N-Style, were they like the first graphic company, or there was Technocell.
Remember MXA that had the high fluorescent, cool, thick graphics and the crazy seat covers that had like the embossed or, I don't know, pressed seat rivets, you know, or grip rivets now. I don't know, you know, call them ribs.
But it was first in the States then?
I don't know if Factory Effects was doing graphics yet, but I feel like they kind of started at the same time. You know, Rob came up with those numbers that, you know, his big thing, they wouldn't chip or spray off with the pressure washer. That was this whole thing. And they took off, and then it went into backgrounds and the CF numbers, and then ultimately graphics. I can't say that we were the first, but I know that he had all the best teams at the time.
Yeah, I remember that. It was, all the teams were installed.
Everybody, yeah. You know, the 8-inch pros numbers were on every bike. You can still see them to this day. And I used to laugh because, you know, Rob had said his uncle had drew that font, which I don't, obviously Rob is a straight up guy. I don't think he's telling the story, but I was at Carl's Jr. I'm like, that's the same font on the number that you get on the table.
yeah, right.
So I don't know, your uncle might've been tracing what he saw on the Carl's Jr. thing, but who knows?
Well, he's waiting for his Western bacon.
Right.
I remember it was really cool because I had a relationship with you guys. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, man, can I get some of those silkscreen number plates?
Oh, yeah.
And, Before anybody else had them. The teams, right? Because it wasn't digital back then.
Nope.
Silkscreen. So
yeah.
I would get my 10s.
Yep. You were always 10. That's what, your name was 10 for the first 10 years I knew you. Rob only called you 10.
Yeah. But pretty crazy to think how different the graphic game is now from back then.
Oh,
I mean,
it's wild. I remember telling Rob that the last time I worked for him before I made the choice to go to Parts Unlimited, that I'm like, hey, we need to adapt to the market. It's changing. Like, kids are coming out of school with graphic, or even figuring it out, not even graphic degrees, in graphic arts, and they're buying printers and they're making graphics, and it's getting saturated. Like, now you can make it custom.
Yeah.
And, in typical Rob fashion was like, you're just lazy. You're weak. You know, you got to assume how to sell. And I'm like, okay, man, I'm just telling you it's changing. And then you see Factory Effects adding like hard parts and clothing and all things they did. I'm like, you got to do something more than just graphics, because any kid can figure it out now. I mean, it's crazy when people do graphics. And obviously there's still, you know, guys like Ryan at N-Style, Thrall Syndicate, Era, Backyard, the factory backing guys you talk about, those guys are icons and they've been around for a long time and they're legit. I'm not saying the other people aren't legit, but they still have a stranglehold. I think Ryan's, advantage, he has a lot of teams.
Yeah.
You know, like Decor has some teams. Those guys are still legit, but I see some random stuff at the track when I go and I'm like,
right?
Who printed that? Where'd that come from? Who gave you permission to use that logo?
So back in the day, people used to buy team replica kits.
Yeah,
right?
Oh yeah.
And I think those were like printing money, right? It was super easy for you to sell to dealers.
Back in the day, it was easy. I mean, I worked on I had East Coast territory, and John Bland, who I believe is at Western Power Sports again now, but at the time came from Pro Circuit to work with us. And he did West Coast and I did East Coast phone sales. And, we were selling $1 million a year in stickers back then. And because the team kits were just huge, and guys would Mike Teagan from Magnum would call and he'd be like, I want 10 of these, 15 of these, 20 of those, 30 of those. And if you didn't get it right, then it wasn't okay. You had one shot with him.
Yeah.
And it was like $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 orders at the time in stickers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it got to the point where the distributors kind of made it easier for everybody to get stuff quickly. So you didn't have to stock deep. You could just stock wide. Mm-hmm. And some of them you could order by 6 PM and have it the next day.
Yeah.
So they stopped stocking graphics because they'd fall down in the packaging. They would, shrink over time. And now with the customization, I don't even think anybody stocks graphics anymore. Yeah. I don't even know if anybody, even the manufacturers inventory graphics, I think they just make them to order now. Mm-hmm.
So during your time at InStyle as a salesperson, mm-hmm. you obviously developed your craft, your
yeah.
silver tongue on the phone. But I mean, yeah. you also learned a lot about the industry and stock and demand and backorders yeah. And strategies for sales and whatnot, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of what I think ultimately led me to be a part, you know, aside from bringing an investor into Fast House when we started, but my knowledge in the industry is what Kenny would come and have meetings with me about, like, hey, how does distribution work? How does B2B work? How does B2C work? You know, what are the margins? You know, what do you think the best ways to go and do? And based on my experience, I was able to answer those questions from him and his brother-in-law, who's one of the partners.
Yeah. So how long were you at InStyle and when did you leave?
Oh, boy. So I was there. I was worked there three times. I got fired once, the only job I've ever been fired from. And then I got back again. So I got out of high school, 1994. I was there until I think like 96. And then I went to work for Frank and O'Neill. Frank and my dad had a relationship through a partner of Frank Kashar from O'Neill. His buddy, Mark Costa, who he worked with my dad at Rocketdyne. And they brought those Pro Style levers around to Larry because they wanted Axo to distribute them.
Pro Style levers.
And that's how I met Frank in my garage at my house when I was 13 years old. And he was like, shook my hand, squeezed it, and he was buff then, dude. And he's like, stay in school. That's what he told me right at my face as a kid. I'm like, oh, this guy's gnarly. But they were trying to get a distributor for the lever, and Jim Hale turned it down, but they said, why don't you guys talk to Jim O'Neill?
Yeah.
That's how their relationship started. So he gave me an opportunity when I needed a job, and I did really well there. The first time I had all these key accounts, and the first time around, actually, Frank wasn't there. Second time around, Frank was there, but he gave me an opportunity to work there. And I did, I made a ton of money the first time. And then I quit cause the commute, I was driving from like Roseman and Lancaster to, you know, they were way out there then in Simi Valley, not as mm-hmm. far as they are now, but, it was a long drive and I was, you know, even then it was expensive to drive to work in a Toyota 4x4, went back to InStyle again for a couple of years. This is late 2000s, or I'm sorry, late 90s going into 2000. That's when, you know, there was a weird thing that went on with the, you know, that caused Rob to have to make a decision. And unfortunately, he made the right decision for the company at the time, but it was under the false information. Later on, we cleared that up. But there was a bike that was sent out to us that we were supposed to get. And then it was going to be, this guy was going to buy it, but it was supposed to be brand new. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was like rusted and beat to crap. And the guy that was going to buy it's like, I'm not buying this. And then that guy turned it into Ryan and I stole the bike. So yeah, it was a weird deal. And it was from a shop in Ohio, and I'll leave it at that. But it was good for me because Rob said, I think you'd do really well if you sold cars. So I went and sold cars in 2000 to 2002. And then Rob brought me back in. So I went back to work for Rob again. And then I was there till 05.
Wait, let's pause for a second. So selling cars.
Yeah.
Used cars or new cars?
All of it.
All of it.
Yeah, I worked for this
guy. I could see you selling used cars.
Oh, they were there. You make more money on those, you know, because they buy them cheap and sell them for what they're worth. It's crazy. I made great money. I mean, one month, the best month I ever had, I made $22,000 and like 12 of it was cash.
Wow.
Because they were doing the spiff thing and they bit him in the ass. They were like, every car that sold, the spiff would triple, quadruple, keep rolling. Mm-hmm. So like I sold like the 65th car of the week and it paid like $7,000 cash.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was good. Yeah. I sold 5 cars in one day once. That was cool at a car sale. I mean, at a tent sale where you go and just, you basically do just bringing people in. Mm-hmm. It was good. I had fun. It was, but you work a lot of hours. I mean, it's, you work bell to bell, they call it. So you're there 12 hours. And then on your days off, if somebody comes in and says, hey, I was working with Fonzie. Well, if they call you and you don't come, then that whoever helps gets half a deal.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of work. It was a good experience, you know, to learn how to deal with people in a different type of sales where they're coming to you instead of you going to them. I didn't do very good at the first year because I felt bad. I felt like I was ripping people off. And then I left for a few months and then I went back and because my dad got ill. So I went to help him out a little bit. And then I went back to work and that's when I just crushed it. Like I was averaging 20 cars a month, you know, and it was good money. Like a lot of it was cash. And it was fun and it was a good experience. But when Rob had called me to come back to InStyle, I was like, I'm out of here. So these guys at this car dealership, like they advanced me like $6,000 when my dad was sick with cancer. And they said, you have to sell 60 cars or stay here for 3 months before you can leave. So I did like the 60 cars in like 2 months and I left mm-hmm. and they tried to come after me for the money.
Oh.
Yeah, it all dropped in the end, but it was pretty funny. It was interesting, but it was a good experience. This guy owned, he had, the reason why I tell you I sold new and used, this guy owned Nissan, Volkswagen, Kia, Honda, Suzuki, Subaru, Isuzu, and Mazda. So he had 9 franchises and Honda. He owned the Honda dealership too. And Jeep, gee, I'm missing them all. There were so many. The guy, he had 2 shops in Palmdale, Lancaster that we could feed from. you know, and go to both locations and sell new and used. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we had the market cornered in the Valley for almost everything other than Toyota and, you know, the big trucks.
So you're killing it selling cars, make a lot of money.
Yeah.
But you're not working in the sport that you're passionate about.
No, I didn't
about.
Even go to a Supercross for those 2 years.
So
I was embarrassed that I
that
left.
That has to be.
You still let me borrow bikes though while I was doing that. You let me borrow the Service 500. And I appreciate that, but it scared me. Dahmer rode it at Gorman's like, this thing's fine. I'm like, I'm afraid of it.
But I mean, it has to be, you have to feel a little bit hollow, you know?
100%. I felt disconnected from the people and the sport that I loved. You know, and it was tough. It was hard to, you know, it was sad. It bummed me out a lot. It was, I mean, I was cool that I saw my friends that were in it, but some people treated you different. Like when you couldn't do anything for them anymore. Oh, you're not that end style. Call me when you get back in the industry. You know, it's like, wow, I thought we were actually friends,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it was hollow. I didn't ride that much. I would watch the races, but I didn't go for those 2 years, which is the only real break I've ever had in going to Supercross because Larry being my neighbor, my dad worked for it with him too. So I got to go to races when I was a kid all the way up to that point. And hollow is a good word for that. It was sad, but you guys still kind of kept me in. You guys stayed, you know, you guys stayed loyal to me and my friends.
So you went back to N Style.
Yep.
And then you left N Style to go to parts.
Yeah. So I we did a program through N Style trying to get graphic sales going to go to Parts Limited. And they were doing the Supercross showcases at the time. Mm-hmm. And Greg Blackwell at the time, who was the president, had came to visit us and said like, listen, if you guys, you want to grow your brand, you got to get involved in these showcases. So we invested in those showcases. And what that would require me to do was fly into a race, go to a show, like see dealers during the week, and then go Thursday night and do the little pitch that we did in the show. And the dealers would get their tickets and have some food and then go to the race. So I would go to the races. I did that for 3 years. I met Jeff Fox quite a few times through that. And for some reason, the guy just liked me. Mm-hmm. So he came to a meeting at InStyle one day and he walks into the conference room and he says, I'm not going to steal this kid from you, Rob. But he goes, if he ever needs a job, he's got one. He goes, every time I see him, he has a smile on his face and he's everywhere he needs to be. And Rob was like, oh, well, then a few months later, I got approached where I actually met my ex-wife now, but at the time, I did a project with her through InStyle. And then her boss at the time offered me a job in Indy. And it was like almost double what I was making in InStyle, like literally damn close, right?
Indianapolis?
Yeah, the Indy show. We're at the Indy trade show and he took me out to dinner. He goes, let's have some real talk. Like, I want you to come over and help us develop this gear line girlies, you know, with us and get it going. I said, you know, and the money, I mean, literally I was making like 40 grand at InStyle and the guy paid me like 80.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like a kid. I had no clue what was going on, you know, so I went and I left. So that's why I left before I went to parts.
Yeah.
But during that time, Blackwell called me, Greg Blackwell. He says, hey, are you available? And I'm like, yeah, I would love to have a chat. You know, I go, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm spinning wheels every day. This guy has been working on his other business, not even what I came here for. So I was like, this is weird. And they said, well, Mark Ferris had said that, you know, you'd be the good guy to come do the showcases for Smith because their guy's going to transition to a different position within our organization. And he goes, are you interested? I said, yeah. He goes, what are you making? I told him, he goes, shit. He goes, actually I misspoke. I mean, the guy at Girlies paid me 65. I told Greg I was making 65. He said, shit. Yeah. And then, you know, but he goes, well, let me see what we can do. Talk to Mark. They worked it out. And that's when I went into parts as the Smith brand manager. And then traveled, you know, for 5 years, 3 weeks a month, almost every race, doing the showcases and the tour. And that was my stint at parts. And then I kind of saw the writing on the wall at parts. I'm like, hey, you know, things are getting a little squirrely again. I go, even though we helped sell, we're an expense. Like they have to pay for our food, our travel, you know, our salaries, our insurance. I go, we're going to be the first to go. So when Mark said, hey, we want to pull you out of parts and put you into Smith, you know, have you come work for Smith because we're going to focus, go dealer direct. They pulled out of distribution. Mm-hmm. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, I feel like this is a house of cards, this brand manager program. And for sure as shit, I quit. And 3 months later, they laid off everybody in that program. And I had already had another job. So Blackwell was a little bitter with me at first, but then a few months later, he goes, you were the smartest one of them all. He goes, you know, I said, yeah, you know, you saw the writing on the wall. So it was good. It was fun. It was like I said, I've been very lucky. I've got to do a lot of cool stuff and I'm very fortunate for those experiences and the people and the relationships that I've made. And that's why I've gotten, I think, where I've gotten in this industry so far.
So then you're in-house at Smith.
Yeah, I was in-house for 1 year. And then the Italians that bought the company, it's called Safilo, decided that was a nonprofit. The least profitable entity of the brand was the Moto Goggles and Moto Division.
So that's when they pulled out of Moto.
Here I am with no job. know nothing, left parts. Like, you know, I'm like, what do I do? Am I going back to O'Neill? Am I going to call Frank? You know? And, I decided to create my own brand management company at the time. And I had called it Rep Connect because I had relationships with all the parts and Tucker reps. And between the two of them, there's over 300. And I had, you know, permission from the regionals to work with them. So I pitched it to like a bunch of companies and, you know, they gave me a chance. Maxima came on, OGO came on, Smith stayed on, Healy on a level, and then Torque One Grips. You know, Rob negotiated my rate way down. What I had was a package was where they would just pay me 40 grand each and I would cover all expenses. I would travel nonstop like I did before. They wouldn't have to pay for it. I'd be at all the shows, you know, wherever they needed me to be. And yeah, I did that for 2 years. And it was good. The only scary part is that you get to like October, November, are they going to have the budget for you to do it again? Mm-hmm. So, three of them stayed on with me both years. And then I had Yoshimir at the end of the second one. And then another, I can't remember who the other one was, so long ago now. And then I pulled the plug on the whole thing. When I met, you know, this guy, Chip Bessie, who came into Fast House as a partner, I worked for him, running his distribution company at the time.
Was that?
It was Linvic Products. Linvic. Yeah. Linvic. Yeah. He hired me in and it was great. And I had to drive to Anaheim, which was crazy. I mean, it took me 7 hours one morning to get there. So I just started staying down there during the week. Yeah. But so I went down there and I did that program. And that's kind of where I kind of felt again, kind of hollow because I was in the industry, but I was like at a little small regional distributor, you know, and it was good though. We did really good the first year. I think we did like 9 million and I had brought in like a bunch of the people that I knew to expand the power sports offering. Mm-hmm. And then they ended up blending that business with a marine business from Ankeny, Iowa. And that's kind of when the focus, I think, it just got, they try to have marine reps sell fat part, you know, power sports and vice versa. And it just was tough. It's a tough bridge to cross, you know? And, so it just, in the end, I think Chip sold that. And during that time I was doing that for him, Kenny came to me and he goes, yeah, I hear, you know, people with money, you know, that want to invest in businesses. And I think I really want to go after Fast House. And, you know, and I've loved the name since I first saw it on his bike back at LACR Day in the Dirt in the early 2000s. And we've had all those conversations about, you know, leading up to that about how distribution works and just, you know, what the best way to take it to market was. And we went and pitched it to Chip. And the first time he was like, wasn't really getting it. He's like, I think you have a great idea and a great name, but what are you going to sell? Because at that time it was just an idea, right? And maybe we could do gloves and do this or that. And he's like, well, I'm not going to invest in a big party. Like, that's just not, you know. So fast forward 2 years. Kenny's making moves, like things are happening, you know, and I'm like, yeah. And he came at me again. He goes, I think we should pitch it to him again. I go, now you've got stuff. And, And I said, and you know, these Red Bull jerseys are crushing it. And this is a base to start. And we went back and pitched to him again. And then they worked out a deal. We all worked out a deal. And that's where it started in 2015. And we moved into our first building.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're like full-time Fast House employee now, right?
That's all I do is Fast House now.
But are you still through Linvic?
No, that's all done. He sold that. That's gone.
He did?
Yeah, he sold it. During like his last year, he was kind of phased me out. I just basically handled some key accounts. I wasn't like the regional manager or the power sports manager anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, and then ultimately he sold that business off. He split off the battery business to another guy. I still helped that guy out and with some key accounts. But then sold the marine business sold completely and the power sports was completely shut down. Mm. Yeah. So Linvic is gone.
Gone.
Yeah.
And you're like, percentage owner of Fast House, right?
Correct. Yeah. So for bringing in the initial investment to start the brand or well, to inject cash into the brand, to get the brand going, Kenny already had the brand going. Chip gave me some, like a finder's fee, you know, for bringing it to him. So yeah, there's five original guys that, you know, Kenny, Tim, Dan, Chip, and myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. You probably know the story that Kenny tried to hire me.
Yes. I know that story. Yeah.
Yeah. So he came to me. So what year did you go?
2015, October, when we moved into the buildings, when I technically started working for him.
It was probably around 2013.
Then. He was going to hire you is what I remember. He told me he was planning on it.
Yeah. Because Kenny and I have always been buddies since Day in the Dirt.
You guys go way back.
When he's always been number 41. I just remember battling him at Day in the Dirt all the time or at LA County.
Yeah.
But, you know, things are clicking and we're cruising at Transworld.
Mm-hmm.
And Kenny's like, hey, I want to have a meeting with you. And Sherry Ridenour from Troy Lee was a big catalyst. Like, yeah, I want you to have a meeting with Kenny. And, you know, there's that relationship between Fast House and Troy Lee at the time.
Absolutely, yep.
But I met Kenny at this restaurant in Norco and with Sherry, and we sat down, and I didn't know what it was about.
Right.
And he's like, how happy are you at Transworld? I go, I love it. Yeah, I love it. I'm running the world's biggest motocross magazine, the number one title in the building. You know, my boss is hands off. I love it. It's great. He goes, well, I want you to come work for me. I'm like, what? Helping with entries at Day in the Dirt? You know?
All right. Like, what do you want me to do?
Fast House.
Yeah.
We're going big with it. And I was like, okay, I like you. I like your style. I like all that. And, but what are you guys doing?
What am I working for?
He couldn't answer it. He's like, I don't know yet. He goes, but it'll be a big statement if I get you. You know, like, my LF Transworld just joined Fast House. And I was like, okay, but I make this much.
Right.
And he's like, oh, I can't pay you that.
Right.
And so he offered me, like, I think considerably less, like $30,000 less.
Yeah.
But a pretty sizable chunk of Fast House. Yeah. And I was like, okay, that's great. But what is Fast House? You know, like, at the time, he just made those t-shirts.
Yeah. That we sold at Day in the Dirt, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, can they make t-shirts and run a bitchin' race? And I was super flattered, you know, but I was just like, you know, I've got a family.
Yeah.
I've got a house. You know, it's just.
At that time, it would have been a big risk. Obviously, looking back now, it might have been cool, but.
Yeah. So, you know, I had to pass.
Yeah.
But it was cool for me to see what Fast House became shortly thereafter. It's like, when I sat with him, I really think he had no idea he was going to do gear.
I don't, at that time, I think you're right. I don't think that was his intention. We had a good thing going with Troy Lee. That was going to be the pant and the glove, and we would just make the jerseys.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he had the helmets, and it looked good together. That stuff looked tough, right? Those kits looked tough. And I don't think that he even had gear on his radar at that point. Maybe gloves was what we had seen initially pitched, you know, as an investment opportunity. But I don't think at that time he was 100% set on it, you know, as a gear being a big chunk of it, because we always just thought of it as a casual lifestyle brand, you know?
Yeah. So you were there from the ground floor with the gear then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually, you know, I went to, I don't know if I'm allowed to say their names because they're still in the industry and I don't want to get them into any kind of trouble, but I went to some people that I knew from the past that have done gear forever. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you could figure it out real easily. And he helped us out. He had good relationships with the factories based on what he does and design, and knew how to build a pant and a jersey and a glove. And the first samples came back perfect. Like, the first ones came back perfect.
Yeah.
And they've never been perfect since. They were perfect that first round. And we got lucky, and we got stuff within 90 days. Like, the first run, it was insane. You know, I remember, you know, we met with Troy and we said, hey, this is what we want to do. And we'd like to do it with you. And it just wouldn't have worked. Like, the way that he wanted to do it was just basically us putting a logo on his pant and then selling it at a premium price, which, you know, yeah, that was cool, but I don't know, why would somebody pay $50 more for the same pant that they could get without the Fast House logo?
Yeah.
So and at that point we already had samples that, you know, that we had worked on. So, and he was very open and honest with us about how complicated it is and how hard it is to do it, which he's right. But we had worked that out already. So this person who helped us really fast-tracked it for us and got us a black and white and I think red set, the first three kits, you know, grindhouse pant, glove, jersey, and it nailed it. And then that's what we introduced to everybody. It was the first launch was Mammoth and then Day in the Dirt later that time. And then obviously the project we did with Tyler Bierman and Darren Durham to the East Coast is Toast really got the exposure for the brand, I think, the first on television, you know, those guys wearing it. You see all the guys in the Fruity Pebbles looking gear, and you see a guy in solid gear, like, wait, what is that? You know, because our stuff is just so plain and simple.
The striped arm.
Yeah.
So you guys came in with a very unique design, kind of a retro-ish type thing.
Yeah.
The first gear, though, was pretty standard.
Yeah, right? It was basic.
Is that baby steps? Like, well, we'll just make standard stuff right away? Because I remember when you first made is it the Raven pant that was stretchy?
Yeah,
the Raven pant. That was a big deal when you guys came out with that. A
huge deal, because we had talked about initially that never doing that. Like, you know, Kenny just wanted to keep it simple. He was all about the grindhouse pant and just doing a bunch of jerseys and cool gloves.
Yeah.
And then the demand started coming, and then the philosophy or the theory changed that we needed to do more than just a entry level pant. You know, that we felt was entry level.
Now, was the response and the sales, was it just like overwhelming? Like, 'cause I, You guys gained a lot of momentum in a short amount of time.
It's crazy. So I remember it was like December, like December 15th or 10th or something, somewhere in that middle of December. And I got my first order from my first distributor. It was $15,000. And we were all like, what do we do? Like, oh my God, you know? And it was Lusty Industries in Australia, who also distributed Troy Lee, which I think that was the attraction for them, is that, you know, cause we were together before. And that was my first order, like big order. Yeah. You know, and it was awesome. And yeah, and then it got to the point where we were only ordering like factory minimums, right? So it got to the point where it was like a feeding frenzy, where like we were taking from distributor orders because we didn't want to take it from our retail people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was quick. I mean, we were selling out of everything because we were doing minimums, you know? Yeah. So I think minimums were like 1500 pants and like 300 of each jersey, or I'm sorry, 1000 of each jersey, or I might have that flip flopped. I don't remember at the time. And I'm like, oh man. And it was going faster than we can get it. And we were having to like take like Rob Peter to pay Paul a lot. Like my distributors would sit there and wait to be full. So they would go take a glove or a jersey from a retail customer because it was in those boxes, even though it was allocated to a customer. Yeah, it was crazy.
Kind of a good problem to have, but still troublesome because you're growing faster than you keep up with.
Yeah, absolutely. Which has been the case for us even still, you know, even through the rough year that we had last year, we still finished up. Yeah. So, which is good for us because, you know, this industry is tough, right? Or was tough through the COVID hangover, as we like to call it. Yeah. But yeah, at the time in the beginning, it was like, if you could find Fast House, you bought it and it was gone.
Yeah.
So if somebody had it, I felt like, you felt like you were part of a club because it was limited, basically. Everything we did was limited, even if it was unintentional, but it felt that way. And I think it created a sense of urgency for people to, if they could get it, they got it. And if you had it, you felt cool. You know, it's like,
I think Dahmer would agree with this, but I know, I think maybe Jordan Powell said the same thing as me, but when the Fast House first came out, mm-hmm. that year at Day in the Dirt, everyone that was in Fast House was kind of a dick.
Yeah.
Like thought they were cooler than shit. Right. Right. And it was like, cause like to have it was hard to get.
Yeah.
And so like not too many customers had it. It was like inside
more the crew. Yeah.
And the stuntmen and everything. But I just remember it was like, dude, I don't know if I like this vibe right now. Cause like, it was like so exclusive, like the it boys, you know?
Well, that wasn't intentional. And I didn't know about that till now, but yeah, I could see that, you know, at the time, cause it was hard to get. And you were like, yeah, if you got it, you were the guy.
Yeah.
And we made sure our guys had it to help promote it, to mm-hmm. get it to where it's at now. Yeah, it's been wild. And what's cool about the brand is we're not a gear company. We're a lifestyle brand that happens to make gear.
Yeah.
You know, we have mountain bike gear, as you know. We have a great mm-hmm. partnership with Bell that's going, I think, our seventh or eighth year. We've been with Red Bull almost 28 years, you know, 27 years, going on 27 this year. It's been amazing. Like this, the relationships and the things that have helped propel this brand and the way that people have taken a liking to it. I think it's the name. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the simplicity and design. Yeah. Yeah. But like you said, growing pains, man, it's real. It's like, you know, now that we have like 44 people that work there, I don't even know all their names. In the beginning, it was six of us, you know? Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. I try to know their names, but they rotate out quick. You know, they, warehouse guys are on, I think on a temp company. So they just rotate them, but
yeah. Do you remember the first year you had the Raven pant?
Yeah, I finally got a compliment from you about how much you liked them.
Yeah, they're good. But, you know, it's funny because they were
thin. And then you ripped your ass, thin, right?
Yeah. A whole shot, Day in the Dirt.
Yep.
Led up the hill, led down the hill, and, fell on the bottom of the hill.
Oh, yeah.
And I was on my hands and knees getting up, and some guy hits me with his foot peg in my ass and dragged me,
That's right.
20 feet, like, with my pants.
Hooked you.
Yeah. He caught my belt.
Mm-hmm.
The
strap, yeah.
The strap. But I got up, and I'm like, fuck, I could still win this race. And I go in, and I remember going down the pavement going, why is it so drafty back there? And I reached back in my ass, and my whole butt crack was showing.
No, dude, you came by at the finish line, and you're like, I'm like, what? You're like, oh, my God, your whole ass was out. You did the Sacagawea before Cameron did.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it was just my ass.
Yeah,
It wasn't the rest.
Yeah.
But what is has there been a challenge? Because, like, I used to joke about this with Frank at O'Neill. I go, dude, why would anyone buy the 1995 gear when it looks the same as the 1991 gear? But like, you guys have always maintained this retro classic look, right? Yeah. So has a lack of major changes presented a sales problem, or is it just you guys?
Not that I've seen. I mean, the Grindhouse is like tried and true. You know, there's like, I think a lot of the apparel companies have a staple
yeah,
pant that's, you know, that lasts. The higher end stuff is made for performance, and it, you crash, it'll rip, you know, mm-hmm. or you hook it on a bush, and you know, you got a guy riding off road and he stabs a tree, stabs through it and rips it. You know, the other stuff I think is a little bit more bulletproof. So that's been a staple, but I feel like people are, they keep that as a base and then they're adding they're peppering in the high end stuff to have mm-hmm. like a race day kit, if that makes sense, like a practice kit and a race day kit. And our grindhouse stuff, unless I'm misspeaking, is still our number one selling pant. The black grindhouse pant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
what's the best selling, I don't want to say gimmicky, but what's the best selling themed jersey?
The 805.
805 beer.
Yeah, those things. We couldn't even make those things fast enough, which is crazy because they only distribute it to like 16 or 17 states and uh-huh. it around the world. I don't know if it's because it says gas and beer. I don't know. But that thing was just, we couldn't even get them fast enough. We'd order 1,500, we'd sell 3,000.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. They'd be gone as soon as they got here.
So that's a great partnership.
Yeah, Firestone Walker's been great.
Is there a licensing agreement there? Like,
yeah.
Are they making money off it too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a mutual, just like our Bell deal and our Rebel deal. Yeah, it's the same. Mm-hmm. You know, they have it. They sell it in their stores. They're a customer as well as we're a customer. And then we also pay royalties.
So
we
sell it. You buy them at the brewery?
Yeah, they have a little display set up. Nice. Yeah, with the stuff. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. What about the, the one I always thought was cool is that all white kit. White Lightning, I think that was cool.
Oh yeah, that was the stuff they did for the Hell on Wheels, where they had them wear that jersey with it was a t-shirt printed, but with the white jeans and boots, because they would do the Hell on Wheels, the couple flat track teams they did. Yeah, that was a good looking kit. Darren Durham actually raced in that same look at Vegas, but we put Viva Las Vegas on it, and it was the mudder.
Yeah,
and he was wearing like 501 white jeans and that mud and water. That had to be brutal, like trying to ride with those pants when they're wet.
I'd say the most unique thing that you guys produce is the Motorols.
Yeah.
Where the hell did that idea come from?
I can't say where the idea came from, because the guys in the art department, I think were just goofing around, and then I actually named it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just making a joke, but I called him Motorol, our Moto All. And then they added the R because they'd already trademarked it. But believe it or not, we were like, this is either going to be a hit or a miss. And we put them on TV at Imagination, and boom, like those things, the white ones were gone.
Yeah.
In the day we released them.
I had a white pair for Dan the Dirt.
Yeah.
So sick.
I love it. I'm glad you like them. Yeah, they're good. Now we're evolving those too. There's going to be a new version coming out. It's more casual. It doesn't have all the pockets and all that. It's just more of a comfortable type looking, almost looks like a corduroy, mm-hmm. For like, you know, more for the side-by-side crowd that wants to have something comfy and casual, but at the same time covers their body so they're not completely getting dusted out. So that thing's evolving. I mean, we did the breast cancer one, the pink one that sold really well. We made youth ones. Mm-hmm. Those are fun. I mean, yeah, they sell out, which is crazy because they're not cheap and we don't discount them. So
yeah,
they're $250 at retail, and they're, you know, I think we only have a couple of the big boy sizes left right now.
I think I told you, I have a buddy, Tommy, that rides mountain bike.
And the mountain bike guys like him, yeah.
He likes them because there's pockets everywhere.
Yeah.
He keeps his phone, his GoPro and everything. And because the standard mountain bike short has like one pocket typically, right? But he likes the pockets in the chest.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude.
And they're free in the waist because they don't have the belt because they're all one piece. So a lot of the moto guys or the off-road guys are like, I can wear these longer too because, you know, they're not – that cinched, you know, tight feeling around your waist. Mm-hmm. And I think the bike guys like that too, because they're just hanging on you really.
Yeah.
You know, they're free floating. As long as the pant leg doesn't get caught in the chain sprocket, I guess you're okay.
Yeah.
Did you hear Dahmer's story about the Motorols?
No.
He's like, man, these things are bitching, but to go to the bathroom, it's a pain in the ass. You got to take them all the way off.
I go, there's a fly.
I go, dude, there's a zipper. He goes, no, there's not. And he goes to his garage. He goes, oh my God, you just made my day.
I think he wears those when he rides his adventure bike.
Big adventure guy, Dahmer. Yeah.
So overall as a brand, what leg generates the most revenue? Is it moto, mountain bike, or casual?
I'd probably have to say casual now, because as of January this year, we are in all 250 Tillys, all doors.
No way.
Yeah.
So is that making it or is that selling out? Because I remember when Fox went into all the...
It's really funny you say that. So we were approached by Tillys our first year and we just said we weren't ready. And then fast forward, they came to us again, and we feel like now I think it could be considered either way. We want to make sure we never forget about our core, but we also have to expand the business.
Yeah.
And the motorcycle market, you know, we're only going to get so much. And, you know, if you want to call it a gear brand and that piece of the pie, like, we're never going to be Fox, right? I mean, they're doing $200+ million a year. You know, that's mega. So we have to take market share from guys like Fox and our other competitors. Whereas in the clothing industry, everybody can wear a t-shirt. Yeah. So, you know, and it's just, it, yeah, we tested in a late, I think Q4 of last year, we tested in 20 doors, gone, 60 doors gone. And then they put in all 250.
So are you going to maintain the motorsports theme with the
oh, yeah, 100%.
Like,
yeah.
Because, like, you know, like when Fox is at Tilly's and PacSun, and yeah. stuff, it's just a Fox head, right?
Yeah. But no, same designs. The original time, when we did the original test, we did specific designs for them, and we decided we didn't like that. We wanted to be to tell the same story, you know, that we tell on our website. So it's the same stuff. It might be, it won't, probably won't be the whole collection. It'll probably be limited SKUs, but yeah, to be in all 250 Tilly's doors is pretty big for us from a casual perspective lifestyle brand. I know Zumiez is picking us up for hats. And then there's some other big stores that have, that I want to test it. We go back and forth about that. Like you said, making it or breaking it. And collectively made a decision that we wanted to try it and see what happens. And so far it's been good. You know,
no, that's going to be huge because it's going to bring widespread awareness of your brand.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, to people we probably would have never reached.
Yeah.
Yeah. Non-endemic. Exactly. It's great.
Because the word fast is cool.
Yes.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's like, just the name, you know,
just some dude that doesn't even have any interest in dirt bikes. Oh, fast.
Yeah. So it's funny to say that. I was in Vegas and I was at the MGM and there was a group of dudes sitting at a table. It wasn't even a supercross or a motocross race weekend. I don't know what I was there for, if it was a show or a personal trip. And six or eight dudes, they all had fast outsats on. And then I went and introduced myself to them. I said, hey, you know, where'd you guys get that? And they said, we got it at Cycle Gear. I'm like, do you ride? And they're like, no, we just love the name's cool. The brand's cool. You know, and another guy like showed me his t-shirt under his hoodie. And I thought it was cool. So I bought him a round of beers and thanked them for their business. And I just thought, like, that's when I realized that this brand is going to be bigger than this industry, you know, because this industry is small. Not everybody rides a dirt bike, but everybody can wear a t-shirt, you know, or a hat or a hoodie or, you know, whatever we make, board shorts or socks or anything we make now.
Yeah. So that was not meant as a jab or insult when I said, is that selling out or expanding?
Oh, no.
You know, like it's just, you know, because some people will be like, oh, yeah, when I see someone in a Fast House shirt, I know they ride moto. Yeah, the brotherhood.
Right.
But now,
like Prius drivers.
Yeah. But, you know, it won't be like that, but at least you're still bringing awareness to, as long as the theme is still moto related, you know, like, you know,
Kenny's very, he wants to keep the brand true to the story, you know, and the core of the brand. And he wants to make sure we never lose our base. So yes, that's actually a very fair question. And yeah, you know, that's something we struggle with internally is are we selling out or are we expanding our reach and expanding the story of this industry? You know, obviously we want to get, not everybody's going to be a rider or a racer, but there might be fans that, you know, that, you know, just like the brand and get into the sport because they like the name of the brand, or maybe they just like the name of the brand.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, I think it's good for us. Like I said, it was a calculated decision. We were approached at the beginning and we didn't do it. We did a test and it tested well, but we decided it wasn't for us at the time. And, you know, fast forward to where we're at now and we felt like we were ready for it. So we took a chance and it went really well. So, you know, I think this brand is, you know, broken through some ceilings and some barriers of this industry where, you know, if you're a skater, you can't wear a moto or you can't wear moto stuff or vice versa, you know, because we have cross sport athletes, you know, we have motocross guys or, you know, bicycle guys that ride moto for fun, surfers that ride moto for fun, skaters, you know, and, I think that's helped us transcend the old, you know, you're a poser. If you ride moto, that's all you can do.
You know, I think what's cool is that motocross is kind of an aspirational sport, right? It's cool. It's like people want to ride dirt bikes or pretend they ride dirt bikes.
Yeah, I've gotten soft in my old age, but I like to pretend I ride them now. You know,
once a year, maybe.
Yeah. Dahmer drags me out the day in the dirt, and I scare myself for five laps. I love when I get lapped because I know it's almost over. But yeah, I realized real quickly that I was more will than skill. And so now it's fun to watch you guys do it still.
Yeah. Hey, I have a question on the casual front.
Yes, sir.
Because, like, obviously, we're all buddies with Twitch, right?
Yeah.
So I remember he gave me some shirts. I'm like, dude, come on, these beefy tee, like these square, heavy things, you know, like so old school and like big, you know, why don't you make the like thinner, like slender cut? Yeah. And he's like, dude, that's not our consumer.
The consumer
says, why you send us these homo shirts?
Yep.
You know, so do you guys have a market, a feel for that? Like, do you?
That's a funny question because in the beginning, we had a guy who sent our shirts back and he sent an email and he said, and they're premium tees. Like, you know how they're thin, they don't shrink, you know, they're thinner. And he literally said, I wouldn't wipe the motor oil off my garage floor with these shirts.
Really?
Yeah, he wanted the beefy tee feel, yeah. The thick cardboard feel shirt. And I get it. There's a market for that. You know, I understand that. But at that time, Fast House wasn't that. We were doing premium.
Do you have both now?
We kind of do. Yeah, oh. we've evolved into that in not all designs, but some. You know, it was really tough to get blanks that were, you know, consistent during COVID because everybody was selling so fast, yeah, yeah. Couldn't get them fast. So we'd get an order from the East Coast or from the West Coast. They would be the same part number, but they were completely different. Mm-hmm. So we tried some new different things that were available. And that's when we led into some shirts that are thicker. You might even notice in some of the ones I brought you guys today that some of them are thicker than the mm-hmm. others. And yeah, they're good. I think, you know, like I said, I think it's funny when somebody doesn't understand it's a premium tee, they think it's a piece of shit. And they're like, why'd you send me this thing?
This cheap shirt,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was really, I'll never forget that guy's email. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
when I was asking Twitch about that, he goes, yeah, that guy's, I don't want my nipples showing through the shirt.
Yep. No, he's not wrong. He's not wrong. I remember when I bought like $200-something-odd of DBK stuff from Twitch when we first started working with him. And I couldn't wear them because by the end of the day, my freaking nipples were like rubbed raw. Because
they're so thick.
Yeah. And I wasn't used to that anymore. Course, right. Yeah. And I was like, oh man. I go, so I ended up giving him my buddy because he's a big DBK fan. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I'm like, I put on one of my shirts or a Fast House shirt that I own mine. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah,
I felt like soft, you know, because that's what I was used to.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, on the casual side, is it t-shirts, sweatshirts, hats? What's number one?
Probably t-shirts, you know, because they're consistent throughout the whole year. Mm-hmm. You know, and then our hats do really well too. I mean, geez, I think there was a store in the Phoenix Mall that did like 9,000 hats one year.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
I was like, what is going on? How does this even happen?
Yeah.
So it's just weird to go from, like I said, I told you earlier, my first order was $15,000 to now, like if you get a $15,000 order, you're like, that's like, oh, you're barely getting enough stuff to tell the story.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Okay. So the thing, I know Fast House from originally, the catalyst of it all was Day in the Dirt.
Yep. Right? That's what put the brand on the map.
So the Day in the Dirt race is like the highlight of the year for a lot of people in California. Like mm-hmm. we really look forward to it. How early are you guys planning that race?
About three. I mean, it's always in the planning phase. I mean, it's always talked about, but Kenny and then the crew really bear down about 3 months out.
Okay. You
know, that's when they start opening up. They start talking about they're going to open up entries, which goes about 2 months out.
Yeah.
And then we start talking. I mean, like the Red Bull guys are on it early. Like they want to plan mm-hmm. way earlier. Like they're talking months before we prepare. But we start really getting into it at about the 3 month mark. And then the 2 month mark, it gets really serious. And then mm-hmm. the 1 month mark, it's like all hands on deck.
Bananas. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's expanded to Australia first and then now Florida.
Yeah. We had an Australia one that went on the first, I think they did three. And then COVID hit and they stopped because they weren't doing anything out there. You know, they were shut down. You couldn't go in or out or nothing. And then we did Day in the Dirt down south, which the first year it got shut down because of COVID. We had the first practice day and then we were at dinner and we got the call. We're sitting there and Kenny looked at me and I was like, that's not good news. And they came and said, you guys can stay the night, but you have to leave. We can't have this event. So this would technically be the sixth year, I believe, but the fifth year they've actually raced. Mm-hmm. Sorry. And it's that one's growing. And then we're adding a surprise, possibly Day in the Dirt.
Midwest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I guess I could let the cat out of the bag. It's going to be a High Point Raceway. We're pretty excited about
wow.
it. Yeah. So they're going to use the GNCC loop. I know enough people have talked about it now that I won't be the guy that let the cat out of the bag completely. We did a little teaser with a question mark, you know, and with Darren Durham.
I did a GNCC at High Point mm-hmm. and I was riding Randy Hawkins YZ250.
Oh, wow.
And I went and I didn't know how the classes really worked. And I thought, well, I'm not a intermediate in GNCC. So I signed up for novice, but mm-hmm. I didn't realize that GNCC novice is like beginner.
Okay.
Dude, so I was winning by a gigantic margin, right? And I go through a water crossing there, and it's bitching.
You told me the story. That's funny.
And I come around the next lap, and, you know, all those crazy fans are there. I'll point right here. So I'm like, fuck, they're dialing me in.
Yeah.
I went through it. They had dammed that water up.
Yeah, so they it was baited like, you.
Dude.
6 feet I was like, deep.
I went over the bars in the water. I was underwater. But the funniest thing is they're laughing. I'm like, these motherfuckers. You know, I was all mad. But they pulled me out. They pulled the bike. They turned it upside down. They started it. They literally picked me up, put me back on the bike.
Patch on the butt and said, go.
And I'm like, these guys are nuts. They just wanted to see me eat shit.
Oh, yeah. That's what they're there for.
They're there to help me.
Yeah.
So
it's like arena cross, right? We all go to watch them crash in the whoops.
Yeah. You know? So, yeah, Day in the Dirt, High Point is going to have to monitor those guys by the water crossings.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. I'm probably getting in a lot of trouble for putting that out there.
So, Day in the Dirt, Southern California,
yeah.
Glen Helen, right? Do you guys have to, strategically prep the track?
Because Kenny does, yeah.
You can't dig it deep like a national too many people get hurt.
You're absolutely right. And Kenny goes in and spends time with John and Scotty Bell, and they go out there and they scout early, right? Like, we're there the whole week leading up to the event. Like, I don't know if a lot of people know that. Brett Bell's out there like almost 3 weeks before building all the structures. And then we come in the final week on that Sunday, and Kenny works on the track as we start building the infrastructure and putting in the store and all the things that we do. But yeah, Kenny, he tries to make it safe as he can, you know. That's why there's never a lot of jumps at Day in the Dirt. It's not our thing. We want everyone to go home. But it definitely gets rough. So, you know, and it definitely, he tries to slow it down as much as he can with all those crazy turns and off cambers, but there's some sections there where you guys are just ripping.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he is very meticulous. That's why he's actually flying to Day in the Dirt right now in Florida to
go
on the track tomorrow. Yeah, with Jason Baker and the crew to make sure it's as safe as it can be, but also fun.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, you got Day in the Dirt down south coming up. I think you're flying out pretty soon.
Yeah, a couple days.
So best of luck with that.
Thank you.
I know there's going to be some all-star contestants out there, you know.
Like
Marvin Muskan.
Our guy Grant. Family. We got, the Grant family. We got Patrick Evans, a couple of our kids, Wyatt Bass and Jackson McCarty from the Hot Wheels team from California. We got Cash Webb and Amari going. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish we could take them all like we did the first year, but with budget restraints, this makes it a little tougher. But we have a pretty good crew going there, and I think we'll split it with the other one. With some of the other kids that didn't get to go, we'll take them to the next one in October.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to November already.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's fun to have you guys.
And anyway, dude, it's been an awesome adventure being buddies this whole time.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, thank you for always, you know, being a friend and giving me bikes when I didn't have one to ride and, you know, being an ear to call when I have issues, you know, in my life. Thank you.
Yeah. So anyway, we're running out of time. So want to thank you for coming on.
Heck yeah.
And thank you guys for checking out the Midweek Podcast presented by Factory Backing.
Thank you guys for having me.
Factory Backing has been producing custom motocross graphics since 2004. At Factory Backing, they prioritize quality by using the finest vinyl materials available. Their competitive prices might seem surprising, but rest assured, they offer top-notch products specifically designed for motocross and the demands of dirt bike riders. Check them out at factorybacking.com. But act fast, as they are celebrating their 20th anniversary with a 50% off sale.